Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Okay. There are those who object to the idea of spota, that it's an unnecessary complication to introduce this extra energy that somehow resides in words and in sentences. So some of these objectors suggest that it's sufficient that the phonemes be heard one after another, even though the sounds very quickly disappear and you're left with only impressions of memory left in the mind of the phonemes that have already been pronounced. Still, when you get to the end, to the final phoneme of a word, when you hear or heard the final phoneme, then the sense of hearing is given the favorable impetus of the correct time for understanding the word. Then the impressions of the remembered phonemes themselves have the power to inspire the understanding of the word. This is the counter theory. The extra special element there is the proper time. And there's actually a statement, where is it? I guess among the Mimamsakas, that there's no perception anywhere in material existence that doesn't involve time. Just like any statement you make about an experience has to have some tense. It's either present or past. There's some element of time in every proposition. Even if you say something is universally true, it's always true. But that always is also a description of time, past, present, and future altogether. And other statements are about things that happen at specific times. So time is always an element in all propositions and in all perceptions. So it's the element of time, of the right time, to understand the word's meaning, that it, the remembrance of the sounds, the phonemes, brings about. So, okay, this is criticized by Kavi Karnapur, this proposal that spota is not required as a separate concept. We're in five, somewhere in the middle. One part of the reply is that you're talking about the time of recognition. Well, that's the effect of the spota. It's the spota that determines that time. The spota, the time in which the spota manifests itself, that's the time of the recollection of the word, or the recognition of the meaning of the word. So spota has to be there. The time is determined by the spota. And there's no lack of evidence of the effect of spota. We can give you evidence in terms of pratyaksha, and also in terms of the special kind of deduction called artapati. First of all, pratyaksha, if you, what you do experience when you hear the word go, you don't remember, you don't think about, what comes to your mind is not the syllables, the phonemes, go, au, and ra, but what you perceive in your mind upon hearing the word go is a cow. The thing that's referred to by the word, that is evidence in pratyaksha of the effect of spota. Also, there is an argument by deductive logic, by what we call negative hypothetical logic. Devadatta is fat, but we don't see him eating during the daytime. Therefore, he must be eating at night. The fact of his being fat cannot be explained otherwise. So we cannot explain without the introduction of the concept of spota how the actual meaning, the recognition of the meaning of words arises. We can argue, okay, you say the varnas do the creation of the meaning or the generation of the meaning in the mind. Well, do they do it, each of them separately, or all of them all together? Let's look at each possibility. If individual single phoneme could do that, could make you recognize the meaning of the word, then you have no use for the other phonemes in the word. Just hearing one phoneme, one syllable, would be enough to recognize the word. So it can't be that each individual phoneme has that power. Okay, then all of them together. But they never all come together. They're never existing at the same time. As soon as one comes into has come into existence, it fades, and then the next one comes. So there is no coming all together of the phonemes. This is the argument. So therefore, we must have a separate entity called spota, which is eternal and which resides in the whole word. And then there is also vakya spota, which resides in the whole sentence, a whole statement. And you can talk about vakya spota, the overall meaning of a whole passage of a text, many sentences. He goes on, Kavi Kornabur, to argue that if we didn't accept this concept of spota, then there'd be nothing to tie the phonemes together in any coherent way. They would just be unconnected. And they wouldn't have the ability on their own without any coherent connection to generate the word. And you gave the example in defending the spotavad. I'm sorry, not the spotavad, but I'm sorry, in the counter proposal that without spota, the phonemes themselves can give us the meaning of the word. Analogy was given, or example was given, of recollection. For example, that's Devadatta, my old friend. I haven't seen him in 20 years. So this is that. This thing, person I'm seeing in front of me, is that Devadatta I knew 20 years ago. Well, the Devadatta you knew 20 years ago isn't there in front of you. You're not seeing him. You're remembering him as a distant memory in the mind. And there's this person in front of you, and you're identifying the two. But actually, it's not a single act of consciousness. It's not a single perception. It's actually two perceptions pushed together. You have, on one hand, a recollection, which is based on perception, on memory of a samskara, some memory awakening in the mind. That's one process. And then you have a whole altogether different process of seeing someone standing in front of you. You put the two together to make an active recollection. But it's actually a complex of two different kinds of perceptions. One perceiving a memory, and the other one of an actual pratyaksha. So it's not a good example. It's not the perception of a word is not such a complex thing. It's a simple perception. But you're giving the example of something that's not even one perception. It's two different perceptions. This is Devadatta. Yes.
We heard an explanation previously that when the phonemes are being passed by, then each of them creates some impression in the mind, and then even if the phoneme literally disappears, still the impression in the mind stays, which has been created by that phoneme. So finally, when several sets of phonemes are being told, even though the physical sound might disappear, but the all the impressions put together will give a different impression. I mean, resultant of that impressions, and that will reveal us the meaning of the word. Like
okay,
this.
But that's being argued against by Kavi Karnapur.
Yeah. So, but the, one of the argument was the varnas are volatile in sense they go away. But this argument which they give is doesn't seem to be refuted here. Even though the physical
we're not denying that samskaras are there. But we're denying that samskara can give you, these samskaras can give you factual, definite knowledge of the meaning of the word. That hasn't been explained, how the samskaras, the different traces of memory of the phonemes, those are traces of sounds. How do sounds turn into meaning? Phonemes themselves don't have sounds. That was the argument. Okay, you say the sounds create the meaning. Do they do it, each of them separately, or do they do it all together? And neither way works. So how do the sounds create the meaning? Sounds by themselves don't have meaning. Somehow the word has a meaning, and you're saying it's produced by the sounds, but sounds, I don't see sounds producing meanings. That still remains to be shown. How do they do it?
The process of recollection and pratyeksha
combined. See, the thing about recollection, it's not considered a reliable means of knowing. It's not certain. Maybe you're wrong. Maybe it's not Devadatta. Maybe it's someone who looks like Devadatta. Because you're basing it on memory, which is not reliable. Because pratyaksha is dependent on memory, it's not a reliable pramana. We need shabda pramana. We need a reliable way of knowing the meaning of words. And if it's based on remembrance, it's not reliable. That's the problem. Maybe I thought I heard kagga, but it was something else. Maybe I misperceived and I'm remembering wrong what I heard. That happens a lot. Psychologists can tell you, those who study perception by senses can tell you that a good percentage of the phonemes we hear, we misperceive or we don't catch them exactly. We fill them in the mind by guessing. People mumble, or even in ordinary speech, not everything is clear. And we fill in gaps within our mind. So the perception of the phonemes is not reliable by themselves. That's the argument. Okay, let's go. Yes, go ahead. This is going to be a short class because this is a complicated section. I just couldn't prepare enough. Yes.
How do you reconcile the fact that Jiva Goswami has an opposite?
Well, I propose that we can accept the idea of Spota as useful, even if it's faulty. Just like we don't, Vyasadeva rejects the concept of Samavaya. Here's another example of a basic concept of one philosophical system being rejected by our authorities. Vyasadeva rejects the idea, the very concept of Samavaya as a different kind of sambandha. You can have sambandha, which is just samyoga, physical connection, like the connection of atoms to make a molecule. Atoms don't inhere in one another, they're just touching one another or near each other to make a molecule. Whereas the cloth is inhering in the threads. It's an integral, a very intimate relationship between the cloth and the threads that make it up. Take away the threads and there's no cloth anymore. I built a house out of bricks and then someone comes and steals all the bricks. I don't have a house anymore. Like that. The house is inhering in the bricks. There's no house without the bricks. If the bricks disintegrate or are stolen, the house is gone. So that's an intimate relationship. Vyasadeva denies that such a separate kind of relationship is valid. It's not even philosophically feasible. According to Vyasadeva, in the second chapter of the Vedanta Sutra. So on the authority of Vyasadeva, we should be rejecting Samavaya. Still, we use it. Kavi Karnapur is talking about Samavaya in some of his explanations here, that relationship. It's logically imperfect, but it's still usable. You know, for practical purposes, we pretend there is such a thing and talk about. You know, phenomenally, it seems to be that there's some special kind of relationship between cloth and the threads. We call that Samavaya. But Vyasadeva, in his Vedanta philosophy, says that that kind of relationship, separate relationship, actually doesn't exist. Still, it's useful. It's a useful fiction. So we can use the Spota concept to explain things. Therefore, we reject it, theoretically, but we still, you know, keep it on for practical use. You know, just like, you know, in our philosophy, we reject, you know, sex is bad, but still we allow for grihasthas to exist as grihasthas, and we don't discourage them completely. Like that, you know, it's a basically bad thing, but still we have to use it. So therefore, there's one sense in which we still use and have to accept Spota just for practical purposes. So one of our acharyas is telling us how to reject it. The other one is telling us how to use it. It's just in different contexts.
Why did he not?
Just like one,
that?
One class you're going to hear how, you know, don't ever get married, da da da, and you know, women are bad. And the other class is encouraging the grihasthas how to be good family men. Yeah, it depends on the context.
But how come he does not mention that here, and he puts arguments after argument proving that Spota is
I don't think they saw that there was any real quarrel, so therefore they didn't try to resolve the quarrel, because I don't think they saw a conflict. So assuming that Jiva Goswami and Kavi Karnapur were aware of what the other one was doing, I don't think they saw a conflict. It's just two different ways of explaining things. Therefore, they didn't, you know, let's get together and resolve our conflict. They didn't think they had a conflict in the first place. Or they weren't aware of what the other one was saying. Yeah.
Is this in the same way, like we tell Tarko Prati Shtavshutavi Pina that logic is cannot be a reliable source of knowledge. So, but at the same time, we use logic in our practical dealing.
We use logic as guided by Shabda Praman. Shabda Praman is our authority. But then we use logic to assist it. Imperfect logic with all its flaws, we use it. So we can use the Spotavad for practical purposes. But it's in the service of our Vedanta Siddhanta, our Vaishnav Siddhanta. Yes.
Poets, the kavis are not necessarily philosophers, isn't it?
Not necessarily what?
Philosophers. The Vedantists, they might belong to any of the schools they might be Mimamsikas, or they might be...
Yeah, well, they have to be educated. They may not belong to the... ascribe to the Mimamsa or the Nyaya views, but they should be familiar with them.
So, basically, this whole thing is coming from Mamata, isn't it? Because Kavi Karnapur is following him in his book.
No,
so
this is...
This
part is, as far as I remember, this argument is Kavi Karnapur's own. It may parallel, and Kamamata may say something similar, but this is, he's not just echoing Mamata here. He's giving his own opinion. You'll see that we're using, again, a little bit later, the idea of Samavaya will come up, I think, in the next section. And that's borrowed from Vaisheshika philosophy. And there's those who won't accept the concept of qualities inhere in the objects, and rather the qualities inhere in things, That's a Vaisheshika view. But we're going on as if that's correct, because it's a useful way to analyze things.
I don't understand much why so much intricate concepts are explained in order to take us to a more easier and in sense like about poetry and.
We need to understand. Language is based on sound. We have to understand philosophically the relationship between sound and meaning. How sounds convey meaning is an important philosophical question, and it should be understood by a poet. This is his material. You know, a painter should know how paint is made. He doesn't make the paint himself, but he should know about how paint is produced. You know, because he uses paint all the time. So poets use words. They should know how words are made. So we should use all the tools at our disposal from all the schools of philosophy to understand how words and meanings have a relationship. Whatever any philosophy has said about it that's useful, we should take a look at that and have a thorough understanding of how Shabda and Artha work together. So that's why this discussion is happening here. First, we have to study sound itself, because meaning is the meaning of sound. We can't study meaning without first knowing what sound is. So first the Shabda, and then we study the Artha. But actually, this chapter is mostly about the Arthas, the meanings that Shabdas express. But first of all, we have to settle what is articulate sound, what is language. So that's what we're discussing here. Philosophical basis of poetry. You could skip it, you can make simplify and leave this part out, but this is a real scientific basis, philosophical basis for poetry. Yes. I see your hand.
Could we say that because sporta is a useful way to explain kavya, because in kavya it happens like that the meaning of the thing is not known until it's completed, and then when it's completed, then suddenly meaning flashes, and then
yes.
That's how kavya works.
Not just meaning, but also like implication. Dhwani is very often like that. There's two kinds of dhwanis. There's dhwani in which you can trace the steps of its development, how the dhwani happens, you know, the elements that contribute to it, and step by step how it evolves. And there's other dhwanis, like the dhwani of rasa, can't be analyzed like that. It's too complex and it happens too quickly. The example is given, if you take a pin and shove it through a pile of 1,000 lotus petals, you can't, you know, notice, you know, as it's going through each separate petal. The whole thing happens so quickly, the needle being shoved through 1,000 lotus petals, that, or 100, say, that there's no, human mind can't slow it down enough to analyze the whole process step by step. So the process is too complicated and too quick, therefore we don't try to analyze it. So there is that kind of spot of dhwani. And it's unanalyzable in practical terms because it's too complex and too sudden. And spot is like that. Yeah. So it's a useful model. Yes. These dhwanis have their own, those unanalyzable dhwanis are a kind of spota. They just suddenly happen. And the most important kind of dhwani is the dhwani, the suggestion of rasa, and that's of that kind. You can't analyze into all the steps one by one of how rasa is evoked. Too complex. We don't try to analyze it. So there may be the minute causes, but we're not going to try to pick them out. We'll just say that there's some spota. It's useful. Maybe there's some way in which all the little phonemes awaken you to the meaning of the word, but there's no sense trying to analyze it. It's too complex. Let's just talk about spota and leave it like that. It simplifies matters. Yeah, I'm sorry, please.
Please. clarify meaning of a few words. Pratyabhijnana.
That's recollection.
Recollection.
You know, I knew David Dutta 20 years ago. I did have experience of him. Mm-hmm. Not like I never saw him. I did see him. I saw him a lot of times.
Uh-huh.
But now, this person who I see now has got gray hair, and he's quite a bit fatter than he used to be. Still, I recognize that's David Dutta. That's recollection. Pratyabhijnana.
Vishrinkala, disconnected, like...
Yeah, Nishringala means, yeah, they're just like...
Disconnected.
Yeah, disorganized.
Disorganized.
There's nothing tying together in any disciplined or organized way.
Uh-huh. Varna avagahini.
Oh, avagahi means...
To dive into the gaha.
No, it just means perceiving.
You know,
delving in the sense of... dipping into the meaning, you know, making contact with the meaning, that's all.
Ah, okay.
Recognizing.
Okay. Recognizing. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. Okay. Let's try the next one. I don't know if I'm ready to do the whole next section, but let's try six. Yeah, but I don't know if I got to the end of it in preparing. But still, I'll take a look at it. Yeah, but... Let me take a little explaining. I'm sorry, I gotta find my place here. Okay, well, we had two kinds of poetry. Two kinds of sound. Shabda is varnatmaka and dvanatmaka. Dvani is not dvani in the sense of poetic suggestion. This is dvani in a more basic, untechnical sense. I think it means, I said one thing, I think it's something else. One way I don't see here in the commentary the definition, which one is, what does he mean by dvaniatmaka? I said last week that the varnas are the mental level of sound in your mind, and that the dvani is the physical, concrete sound. That one way. I think the other way is more correct, though, that the varna is... language, articulate sound, and dvani is unarticulate sound, just noises or music or animals making noises. This is not varnas, it's sound, but it's not varnas. It's not articulate. It doesn't express meaning, not like words do. I think that's what we're talking about. So we have the varnatmaka shabda, that sound which constitutes language, articulate sound, that's of two kinds. Sadhu and asadhu. Excellent and inferior. Excellent language and inferior language. Two different kinds. Now, the interesting question is, how do you define excellent language? What makes it excellent? Okay, so there's, I think, four suggestions here. One, is it that an excellent person speaks it, therefore it's excellent? That's one suggestion of how to determine whether it's excellent. Or second proposal, is it just that it's sunmita? Just that it's wealth. It's let's see. How would you translate sunmita? It's just expressive. It's expressive in an excellent way. It just has a good effect. You just judge by the effect of it. It just sounds good, and its meaning is vivid and clear. Is that the definition of excellent language? Or is it that it's found in the Vedas? Excellent language should be taken right out of the Vedas. That's a third idea. Or fourth, is it just that... it's generated by the process of taking word bases and adding pratyayas. Pratyaya can be a suffix or a prefix or something in the middle, pratyayas, inflections. Is it the combination of proper combination of words and inflections that makes excellent language? Well, okay, if we look at the first suggestion that It takes the fact of an excellent person speaking it to make it excellent speech. Then, if a chandala or other low-class person spoke perfect Sanskrit, it wouldn't be excellent speech, by that definition, because it was spoken by a low-class man. That's not fair. If somehow a chandala hears chandala sitting talking Sanskrit, well, you know, why isn't what he's saying also excellent? Okay, what about the second proposal? That it just has a good effect. It sounds good and it has a vivid meaning. But then, harshly spoken Sanskrit, ugly Sanskrit, inelegant Sanskrit would also be excellent, and it shouldn't be considered excellent. Wait a minute. Oh, I see. No. No, the problem was that harshly spoken Sanskrit that just doesn't sound good would not be excellent speech, but it's still excellent speech if it meets other criterion. Why rule it out just because it's spoken a little harshly? Just like the enemies in battle, they may speak excellent Sanskrit, although they're not speaking very sweetly to each other. So why isn't that also excellent language? It is. So the second determinant, that it should sound nice, that's ruled out. The third one, that it should come from the Vedas, well, then anything else that people say, any of us or anybody, that if anybody says anything that's not right in the Vedas, it won't count as excellent language. That's too restrictive. It has to come right out of the Vedas. And if you have to have a combination of bases and inflections, well, what about names or vocatives and words that don't have an inflection? They could not be included within the scope of excellent language if you have uninflected words. So here's Kavi Karnapur's proposed criterion for excellent speech. It should abide by the rules of grammar. If it's grammatical, then it can be considered excellent. Let's not say excellent. Let's say proper. Proper and improper speech. It's, you know, to be excellent, to be poetic, it has to have something else. But to just be correct speech, it should be grammatical. Otherwise, it's incorrect or improper. Well, okay, then even, I see. I'm sorry, I misunderstood the third criterion. That was that, or the fourth one, that a word is derived by suffixes being added, just like we learn in the Kridanta and Tatitya Prakarana about the derivation of words from a base, usually a root, and then you add some suffixes to make other words out of it. Well, if excellent speech has to be a product of that process of deriving with suffixes, what about words that don't have any suffix, just like a name? Some names are not derived. And some words, some nouns are not derived from any verb. They would be left out of the scope of excellent, of proper language. So if we make the alternative fifth definition that proper speech is speech that conforms to the rules of grammar, then you can have words that aren't derived also be proper language. Like the name ditta. There's no derivation of the word ditta, but there's nothing wrong with it either. It's proper language. This is ditta. It's a good sentence. Nothing wrong with it. But if you say, if you speak in Upabhramsha and talk about the gavis walking down the street, which you can guess that means cow, but it's not proper Sanskrit. So that's asadhu. if you talk in unrefined, unsanskrit speech. That doesn't mean you can't have vernacular languages in poetry. That will be explained later on. But just because Prakrits have their own grammar. If you follow the rules of Prakrit grammar, then it can be poetry. But if you speak ungrammatically, if you don't follow the rules, Sanskrit or Prakrit, then it's low-class speech, asadhu. Okay, so if you want to be a poet, you need some special skills. But if you just want to be a correct speaker, all you have to do is know grammar. That's why studying grammar is good. Studying grammar is very important, so you can at least be a correct speaker, even if you're not a poet or a great philosopher. At least you can put a sentence together. There are many people in this world who can't put a sentence properly together and can't express themselves clearly. So if you are a proper user of language, you can, if you have any ideas in your head, you can express them. Okay? There are people who have ideas but can't express them because they don't know how to use language. So, this apabhramsha speech is low-class, ungrammatical speech. You know, you talk about the goes, gavaha, you say gavi. It's ungrammatical. But still, even people who are not familiar with your speech, they might be able to guess what you mean by it. Corrupt speech can sometimes be understood anyway. So it's speech, but it's asatu speech. It's low-class speech. Not proper, improper speech. Still might get the idea across, but it's not considered proper language. You know, there's a tradition of ignorant people who carry on, you know, a tradition of using incorrect words, and they can understand one another in their corrupt language. But that's asadhu. Asadhu Shabda. But Prakrit language, even though it's technically a corruption of Sanskrit, it has its own proper grammar. It's been taught by sages, Prakrit grammar. And therefore, if you follow the rules, proper rules of Prakrit grammar, then it's also correct language. Okay, that's this Anucheda 6. Any questions about it? In drama, Prakrit is used. Women are supposed to speak in Prakrit. The jokers are supposed to speak in Prakrit. Some of the women who are very exalted might also speak in Sanskrit, but Prakrit is used. The gopis are speaking in Prakrit. Sometimes Srimati Radharani speaks in Sanskrit, but the rest of the gopis, sometimes Lalita Devi, who's elder, she speaks Sanskrit. But most of the gopis are speaking Prakrit most of the time. And Madhu Mangal is speaking Prakrit most of the time because he's a joker. What is Prakrit? Okay, can I answer that question first? It's, well, you're familiar with Hindi. Hindi is, you know, modern, completely corrupted from Sanskrit. What's halfway in between is Prakrit. What Sanskrit corrupted into at the beginning of Kali Yuga, that's Prakrit. After that, around the 5th century AD, further corruption developed into several different languages called apabhramshas. And from these apabhramshas came the modern Sanskrit-derived languages. So Prakrit is the earliest corrupted form of Sanskrit. But it's spoken by women and by less educated people. And it's used by playwrights and sometimes poets. Okay, there's a formalized version of Prakrit. There are different Prakrit dialects. They're not really considered completely separate languages. They're like dialects. Shudraseni Prakrit, spoken in Mathura. And Magadhi Sanskrit, spoken in Bihar. Magadhi Prakrit. And one version of the Magadhi Prakrit is the Buddhist language, Pali. So these, you find them Historically, you find them prominent around the 5th century BC, these different versions of Prakrit. The Buddhists wrote, the earliest Buddhists wrote their books in Prakrit, because that was the language. And then later on, the Buddhists wanted to become fancy, so they started writing books in Sanskrit. But really, they were writing books first in Prakrit. And there's some Vaishnav literature in Prakrit also, especially some dramas by Vaishnav playwrights. But there's even whole poems written in Prakrit. Magadhi Prakrit, Shuraseni Prakrit's the most important, most prominent, and then Magadhi Prakrit and a few others. Which one? You talking about? Where? Shuraseni is Mathura district. But Mathura district, not just this immediate district, but Mathura district between here and Dwarka is the larger Mathura district. And that's where Shuraseni is spoken. From here all the way west to Gujarat. Which one? This is just my theory that Shuraseni Prakrit is actually the original Brijbhasha. I'm just coming up with that idea. It's my idea. Okay. Anything else? Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Just the title, Asadva Sadhu Tayadyopi. Okay, so this is the title of the section.
Title? It's a karaka. It's actually a piece of a karaka. Sometimes,
okay,
karaka is a shloka.
So what's to be implied?
A karaka is a shloka, but he sometimes gives you only a piece of the shloka at a time.
Okay.
You'll see all the shlokas, karakas, listed in front of the book. Complete. But he sometimes just gives a few words at a time out of the karaka.
So is this
It's not a heading. It's not an adhikara. It's
okay.
A karaka.
So it looks like this is the first line of the
karaka? Or the second line, something, you know, some part of the shloka.
And okay.
And you know, there's a pronoun there. That pronoun goes back to either the same karaka or the previous karaka. The actual antecedent is there. And that antecedent is, as explained in the vritti.
Pronoun?
Well, there's a sa there, isn't there? In the karaka?
No.
Okay, no, there is no pronoun there, okay.
I think
it is an implied subject.
It goes for...
Under the karaka, under that snippet, is the vritti, adyo varnatmaka shabdo. It's defining the missing subject.
Okay.
Which is understood from the context of what was said previously. That we were talking about two kinds of shabda, varnatmaka and dvaniatmaka. You can look in the front of the book at the running list of all the karakas, like here. These are all the karakas for each chapter. And you can see it in context by looking in here. I guess I don't have that in the computer file. You have a separate list of karakas? Okay. Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada, Kavi Karna Purakijaya.